Welcome to Polycast, civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
Ed Jim.
With guest co-hosts.
Canuck Soldier.
Vaccine.
Sistine Chapel.
Phil's just trying to troll the conversation, that's all.
Whoa. Everyone loves the Sistine Chapel.
I see your Sistine Chapel and I raise you a nuke.
Oh, hey.
What's that? You pop the nuke and you're going to use it on me? Welcome to episode 158. I'm still Makalua, and with us as always is Dan.
Give thanks for Sid.
Me and team.
My cheese is carefully refined.
Refined cheese, that's interesting. And our two guests this week, John Ryder.
Thanks for having me back, Dan and company.
And Paul Grimes.
Religion is the opiate of gods and kings.
I think gods and kings itself is just an opiate. Distract you, play games, forget the rest of the world.
In the fall patch, 2K Greg announced that the DLL source code is finally going to be released. So modders should be able to create much more advanced mods than they currently can, which is good news.
You know what? I think that was purposely left out of the original fall patch just so we could have this kind of dramatic effect. Oh, by the way, just one more thing.
What are we, Columbo? No, before most of the viewers find my guess.
No. I know who you're referring to, but I never watched an episode to know that that was something that he said.
He does it all the time.
Okay, so you see, I've never watched the show.
Just one more thing. And then it's always his anger where he's figured it out and they thought he hadn't.
Yes, at the risk of dating myself, I might have watched a show or two.
Yeah. Well, there's this magical thing called reruns, so, you know, it's not too dating.
All right, before our audience thinks we're really old, let's try to be a little more modern. Actually, we didn't say zing, it was bazinga. Just so you know, we're good.
Dan's actually really old, by the way.
Now we're not old, we're just all geeks.
Yes.
That's much better.
We are running a game podcast, so whatever. It's all good.
Well, and seeing as how it's on a specific game, too, that probably takes us from geek into nerd territory.
I resemble that remark.
But strongly. You also resemble a troll.
That might be hitting a little close to home, yep. Mounted units, which is a topic brought to us by Sith Fanatics user Mint Candy, who is asking about the value of mounted units in Civ 5, especially since G and K came out. He or she is posing that maybe mounted units aren't all too useful.
He has the sort of war what is it good for vibe going here, so the first thing you could think of is absolutely nothing. But...
No, it's actually absolutely something.
Well,
how's that for an answer? Can we move on? No? Oh, we're going to talk about it more? Okay.
They're fast. Useful. New after attack.
Yeah, I'm thinking that maybe the one unit per tile, you know, makes them, you know, not quite as applicable. You know, in Civ 4, you could stack mounted units and then use their mobility. In Civ 5, you can't do that, and you can't move through other unit tiles, so... I think that kind of really takes the wind out of mounted units in Civ 5.
And I think for also a lot of people, the penalty for cities.
Yeah, that hurts them. Late Civ 4 deity players really favored the cavalry big time. Like, it was probably the number one most used unit among the high-level players as cuirassiers or cavalry in the late cycles of Civ 4. And there, too, like, if you're going to do an early rush, the horsers were better than any of your alternatives well. Even better than a lot of the sort of called unique units that were supposed to be good for rushing. Even then, the horse archers were better. So I don't know if I would put them on quit level in Civ 5. They are not, like, head and shoulders above your alternatives in a given mess so often. But they're not useless, certainly.
Their main advantage is their mobility. And if you're using them properly, you can wipe out your enemy's units with just your mounted units and then move your melee up and have some cannons behind them to take cities. And then your melee are safe because they haven't taken any damage from killing units.
Do any of you just redline cities with siege and then go take them with a mounted, even though you have a penalty, the city's like just about done, so you can take it anyway? Do any of you go for that?
Absolutely.
I definitely use that against other units. Like, start off with indirect fire units, archers, whatever, artillery, and then friggin' roll over them with, you know, your mounted units, or armor, as the era may dictate.
Oh, yes.
I think what Phil is referring to is that a city at zero HP can be taken by any unit, literally, like, guaranteed. So, even in the modern era, you can have your horsemen take a 100-strength city from 5 tiles away or whatever.
And I think also a lot of the negativity towards mounted units comes from the fact that most people play this as a single-player game in whole or in part, and the AI is pretty crap when it comes to using mounted units. And I think it's more critical to be able to use in multiplayer, but I think a general rule is to find a way to incorporate mounted units into your gameplay, because we've already talked about melee and siege. If you go with any one unit, and let's set aside for the moment, for instance, that siege units, you cannot take cities. Let's just set that aside, all those other game rules for the moment. If you just have one type of unit, and you're going to focus on that, at the exclusion or crippling too much in terms of comparable numbers for everything else, it is going to come and bite you in the rear. We already talked about their mobility. Pillaging is also another very significant aspect, and you may be thinking, well, then it's not like pillaging in Civilization IV, especially if you could get your units onto some really nice developed cottages that have turned themselves into villages or towns. That's true, but remember when we talked about the upcoming fall patch last episode? Pillaging tiles is going to award 25 hit points to the pillaging unit. So now you can tie that pillaging not only into mobility and the gold, but you can also tie that into additional combat, which ties right back into what we've already said about using the mounted units to, if not pick off, then weaken those other units so that they're not going to be as damaging to your melee or in particularly to your ranged, which is very vulnerable to counterattack.
Yeah, you can definitely be sloppy in single player with using combined forces. In multiplayer, you definitely have to have a good game plan and use your mounted units in their premium role. Otherwise, yeah, I can understand people who don't quite have that game mechanics knowledge thinking that mounted units have no use at all.
Yeah, Civ 5 really emphasizes the whole combined arms thing. Everything has a role and there's a purpose for it. And if you try to do like you could do in Civ 4 and just whip up a stack of cavalry and go steamroll everything in this pass, that doesn't work so great anymore.
I do think part of it is, too, that the AI does tend to, you know, even with its improvements, and certainly it's improved since vanilla release, oh my gosh, it does tend to just send a wall of crap at you a whole lot. And oftentimes, you know, what units it puts where is still a bit of an eyebrow raiser. And so some of the importance of the mounted units goes away then, because you can easily access things that you probably shouldn't be able to attack anyway with melee. Or, you know, it really doesn't matter what you use, because you can just grind it and kill the AI stuff regardless. Just hit it with a couple ranged units and kill things and don't take losses. You know, that kind of stuff. It makes the mounted seem less useful than it could be potentially.
And further to the single-player point, the AI, historically anyway in Civ 5, really favored building spearmen.
Ah, yes.
And, of course, they just tear your mounted units to shreds. So even though it's not as bad as it was like that for a long time, combined with the penalty for cities. And we've talked before about when Civ 5 first came out, just how strong they were. Mm-hmm. And then they got nerfed, and I think they took, you know, it's kind of like when you go get a haircut and you decide that you want the hair to be shorter because you're sweating too much, it's the summer. Well, I think they took a little too much off the top.
Just a little off the sides. Oops. Your balls.
You never take too much off the top, Dan. Never.
There is also the flanking bonus that your mounted units can provide to support your melee attacks as well. So, yes, you want to be able to move them so they can move in, attack, and then they can move back to be able to support your melee units again when the melee units go on the attack, in addition to protecting your melee units in the first place. They're kind of use your mounted units as a first wave, and they can also, of course, because of their mobility, be used for scouts very effectively. I know there's the, you know, they don't get the terrain bonuses, and they can get hung up in terrain, unlike your scouts, but have to land a mounted unit and it has to sit there. Oh, it's beside an enemy unit. Whether it's barbarian or maybe you're already at war with an AI proper or a city-state, it's more likely that they are going to be able to survive until the next turn and then move away.
Surrounded in town, man, it's fun. But between discipline and flanking, it can still be really painful to get surrounded by those, and mounted can definitely set that up more easily than other unit classes.
And the fact that someone had mentioned, I think it was one of our guests who mentioned about it, that you can't stack them anymore. Maybe it was you, John, then. It's because of one unit per tile, you do have to micro your mounted units. You can say, well, you have to do that with every unit, Dan. That's true, but if you compound it with all of the other negatives, perceived or realized, and people just kind of look away, I think that has given mounted units a bit of a bad rep. But even before we get to that fall patch with those plus 25 hit points, even though it's critical in multiplayer, at least against a human who has comparable, skill level and or technology level, but even against the AI, it can also help you in ways that you may not realize. That's one of the reasons why we're discussing this, because they still do have their place in the present. And then again, looking ahead to the future, given we know what's coming, if you start doing this now, then given all the other changes that the patch are bringing about that you really can't do much of anything with right now, you'll be one ahead. It'll be like, oh, yeah, the pillaging thing. Well, I'm already doing that. I got back into the habit of doing that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Most people are used to spamming out melee units and, the occasional indirect fire unit to pound cities down. And against the AI, you can get away with that. But I think if people get ready to use the new mounted units, that they'll see that they're actually not useless. We can, glide on to using the Air Force.
Oh,
I think Dan approves.
I'm sorry, that's the best I've got.
Yes, we're not talking about deodorant. We are talking using an Air Force. Syntax error. I'm clueless about using this one, and that one being an Air Force. I usually just build ground invasion forces. Neutral concerned face? I don't know. So how do you go about building and utilizing an Air Force? I think it's not so much about building an Air Force that people kind of go, it's actually utilizing their Air Force. And we could go into considerable minutia here, and perhaps we will, but maybe it's just as a general overview. You're very early. So we're talking about, your initial Air Force. I should say Great War Bombers here, so we're talking about Gods and Kings now. The thing about those is they are very good for bombing units, and what I particularly like to use them for are bombing cities. But when you're using an Air Force, you also have to ask the question, the civ, be it AI or human, that I'm looking to attack with these, what is their technology level? Because if they also have the ability to have air units, and the interface can help you out with that in some respects in cities to show you like how many units in that city, that little number that's over the city top to tell you how many air units are in there, you want to do an air sweep. Because you want to have the target enemy's units use up their interception capability, because your bomber is very vulnerable to that. And so if you do that first, I think especially earlier on in the game, you have to have that combination of fighters and bombers. So the fighters go in, essentially give the all clear for the bombers, and then they can come in and do their business.
I think you're right, Dan. This is all about determining whether you have air superiority or not and whether they have significant air defense. And, in the real world, your fighters would accompany your bombers and do that job. But, of course, we micromanage a bit more in the civ world here.
Now, I think it is worthy to note something we talked about last episode. In terms of bug fixes that are coming in the fall patch, keep in mind that in terms of promotions, the interception and evasion promotions are currently reversed, and they are going to be fixed. So while keeping that in the back of our mind, we're going to assume here when we're talking about it that, in fact, that these promotions have been corrected. Another advantage to the Air Force is, and this actually surprises me, are treated like your non-combat ground units in the sense that there's no stacking limitation. So it's not like Civilization IV, where eventually they got around to one of the last patches for Beyond the Sword, or maybe it was even before that, but I think it was Beyond the Sword. You could have 4 in a city, and if you built an airport, you could double that to 8. Well, I have, I think my record is somewhere about 30 or 40 bombers in a city. And the reason it wasn't more than that is because I ran out of oil. Honestly, I maximized the oil usage, you know, that I had, and I had air superiority as well, which helped in that moment, and I'd allied some city-states to get some more oil, and that can be considerably powerful.
Sounds unnecessary.
You see, the thing is, we talked about how if a city is down to zero hit points, any unit that has the ability to attack a city and capture a city can do that. And if it's down to zero, you just move right on in. There's nothing like having maybe a fighter or two, because you have to remember, and actually this caught me from the last patch. I don't remember the AI doing this before, but they got better with having anti-aircraft units surrounding their city. And so what I used to do is like, oh, okay, I know you have the ability to build air units, but I don't see any in the city, so I can just go in with my bombers. And it was like, oh, this anti-air unit just shot, you know, just shot down your bomber. And I'm like, ah, crap.
Still 40?
I know.
I mean, how many different cities do you want to redline in a turn?
Well, see, now
all of them.
I will say that you don't necessarily want to do that. You want to, of course, look at what city or cities it is you think that you're going to want to take, because your ground units have to be in position to either finish destroying a unit that perhaps you used your bomber to attack, or finish taking that city in the turn. And I use the recon capability, which, by the way, jet fighters and stealth bombers have that at the start of their turn. They see everything within six tiles. So it isn't a mission, and it doesn't use up the turn. It happens automatically. But you can also do other recon to see what's going on in that vicinity, and then you can decide, okay, is my focus going to be bombing units or bombing cities? And I have found that depending upon, again, the AI, where they are in their technology level, and I'm sure difficulty level also comes into play here, that really, when it comes to using an Air Force, if you can push a technological advantage, if you can get yourself from having fighters and great war bombers and fighters, and you can get into the jet fighter and the stealth bomber, if we're talking in the information era now in Gods and Kings, that I really, rarely, rarely needed to use jet fighters. I just had stealth bomber after stealth bomber after stealth bomber, but like with mounted units, I'm playing against the AI. And by the time it comes to stealth bombers, if they do have any anti-aircraft units, it's not that many, and the strength of my stealth bombers, they may take a little nick and scratch here and there, but unless they were already very high amounts of damage, I really didn't suffer any substantial losses. And actually, in effect, it can be advantageous if you manage to push that technological progression and get to those. You almost want the AI. I almost want the AI to do that, because then it helps me get more promotions on my air units.
Please attack me and give me free promotions. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, there's no one magic formula that says, okay, at this point, you don't need to worry about, you know, having fighters or jet fighters so much when fighting against the AI now. You know, there are always kind of general things to take into consideration. But honestly, between what fighters and bombers can do, it is extremely powerful, and even if your ground force is minimal or negligible or even, you know, just moderate to what the ground force is for another civ, air units, the air superiority is so substantial that you can just, especially with the stacking ability, boom, 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 that unit is gone.
And people like to say that civ has no realism.
I mean, superiority is still important, but in terms of its dominating effect, when it comes to doing something overseas, yes, you can rebase your units, and you can have it do like the hop, skip, and a jump around the map, but you can put, it talks about carriers here. Now, stealth bombers can only be based in cities, so short of stealth bombers, you can put your fighters and jet fighters and your bombers on aircraft carriers, but they only support three. So when you get into that situation, and I think it'll tie into a later topic as well in a sense, you got to be able to protect those carriers with those jets, fighters, and bombers on there, because they would be vulnerable to attack.
It's just unnecessary. It's the opposite of Civ 4, where the basing limits in cities could hinder your air force, but you could then put unlimited numbers of carriers and fighters onto one tile anyway in the water and just destroy people that way. In Civ 5, you can put as many air units as you want in a city. So what you do is you get a couple battleships, enough battleships to flatten a city, take it and rebase your aircraft there. And now you don't need to worry about your protecting your planes any longer, except for protecting that one city, in which you're now going to completely torch everything on the other continent within a few turns. So carriers take up quite a few resources of their own, and they really don't seem to hold the use of simply taking a city and covering it with, you know, a few admittedly long-range naval units.
Or you can just bulb up to stealth, and the stealth bombers have, like, 20 base range or something, so
yeah,
they can take cross-continent cities. Stealth bombers are ridiculous if you want to get that far.
It's a little harder to do in Gods and Kings, though, from my understanding, than it was in Vanilla.
Yeah, the bulbing isn't as easy.
Yeah,
I agree. The carrier battle group, I don't think in Civ 5 is worth the resources you're going to put into it for the effect of, you know, three planes sitting on a carrier, unless you have no other choice.
In the chat, Y even says the AI isn't particularly bright in using planes, so usually air sweeps are all you need for cover, unless you're attacking some runaway that made more planes than it knows what to do with. Then you can benefit from interceptions too to cover your ground stuff and carriers. Particularly, I like his last point: a stack of planes and horse. What's that? All I want for Christmas is a stack of planes and a horse. And we're coming up on Christmas.
What a pony.
That's another show.
Oh, my bad.
Yeah.
Honestly, we were talking about that here.
Pony.
All right, our next topic is interesting. It's an open mic topic, apparently. Polycast received a little bit of a shout-out in one of the elimination threads. Now, we have linked for our reference quite a few different elimination threads. I wouldn't know where to start here between wonder elimination, map type, civilization, units, unique ability, religious beliefs. And I believe these types of eliminations have been going on for many years in the Civ community. I don't know. I've never been into them, but you know, it is kind of interesting to see how they evolve over time, if you just take a quick look at it. But Gaga Extreme, is that correct, Dan? Or did you mean to put Gaga Extreme?
No, it's Gaga Extreme.
Gaga Extreme it is. Stated, I hope someone from Polycast has to look into the thread. And of course, you know that at least one of us is going to catch that. And it was most likely Dan, but nevertheless, we do appreciate the shout-out.
And we did more than just look into the thread. We're actually discussing the thread on the show.
No. That's fine. But
it's too late. We've read everything. An elimination thread in general. It's a forum-based game with a tie-in to Civ. It is a popularity contest, and it's also a timed popularity contest. Essentially, some of the values may differ depending upon how quickly or not so quickly you want the elimination thread to go. And, of course, you also take into account the number of items. But essentially, think about YouTube liking and disliking. Only the disliking can actually end up eliminating things if getting enough. So, for example, there's an item that you like, you give it +1 point. And then you mark it in green text. If there's an item you dislike the most, then you can, say, give it -1 point, or I've seen it -2, -3, and +2, +3 as well. And you mark the negatives in red. You're to give reasons for why you're doing it and to please only vote within 24 hours. You don't have to give reasons, but it's asked. But as soon as an item hits zero, then that is eliminated, and anyone is asked to, once it is eliminated, that you delete it from the copy. I mean, there is some micromanagement here. I've seen some humorous cross posts as well. You know, someone starts writing a response, and then it takes them a couple of minutes, but like, halfway through their 2 minute they were prepping it, someone made a post, and then sometimes you may or may not catch that, and then I think it becomes, or it should be the responsibility of the person who started the thread, that I think that person should take on, okay, there's been replies to my thread. I need to go through it and make certain there hasn't been human error, or sometimes it could even be on purpose, to make certain that the rules are being followed. And so you can do this for really any aspect of Civ, let me qualify that has a number of items, a number of choices. And although it got closed on CFC, the elimination thread. But if you go onto Civilization Fanatic Center in their forums or any other Civ forum and you do an advanced search for the phrase elimination thread, people who have been titling threads have been very consistent with and saying that this is an elimination thread. So if you do that search, then you'll get results. And if you just tell it to give you results by thread title as opposed to what's in a post, you will very quickly get a more or less concise summary of the different elimination threads. Thank you for that shout out, Gaga Extreme.
We're moving on to our email here from Nick, one of our listeners. And I'll read this out, and then we can dissect his email here and comment on it. Hi, all. Love the show. Keep up the good work. I have a question about Civ 5 military strategies. You know, don't we all? And it's in vanilla, by the way. If you wanted to tech up to rifling before going to war, how far do you usually go towards the education branch as well? Is it worth getting the four techs? Philosophy, theology, civil service, and education that aren't necessary for rifling. I have the research benefits of education, universities, Porcelain Tower, Oxford, that would then speed up your progress to rifling, ? Or would you just get philosophy so you could sign research agreements? I realize, as with all things Civ, there probably isn't a one-size-fits-all answer, but if you could go through the pros and cons of each, and in what situations the different options would be better, that would be really helpful. Also, just wanted to give a shout out to the Mind Team, the Mean Team, for his Civ 4 playthrough. They really helped me improve at that game and are always fun to watch. Cheers, Nick. Straight for rifling, or stop along the way for some of the benefits of the other technology branches?
Yes, go to education.
Yeah, especially when we're talking about vanilla Civ 5 here, because if you get yourself to education, then you could start building the Porcelain Tower. And hey, plus 50% more from your research agreements. And depending upon when you're listening to this episode, and this also ties back into the upcoming fall patch, right now there is double credit being given to research overflows.
Yes.
There's another reason. The amount of time and beakers you're going to have to put into getting to education, so philosophy, theology, civil service, if we're talking about vanilla Civ 5, it's a little over 1,100 beakers. But then if you combine that then with education and what universities are going to give you in terms of your grade scientist points, so you can likely get closer to a grade scientist, the increase in research you're going to get from a university is plus 33%, and then the ability to get to Porcelain Tower. So, I mean, the sooner you get to education, the sooner you can start building the Porcelain Tower, the greater likelihood it is that you're going to get it. And then you can look into research agreements as opposed to, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that you go get philosophy so you could sign, you know, research agreements. I'm not saying, oh, don't sign research agreements even if you can't get to the Porcelain Tower, but it is so worth it. The little bit of extra time you're going to get kind of up front here to get to education, it's going to pay in dividends. In Gods and Kings, it's not so clear cut. But I still think, and I'm even excluding the double credit to research overflows right now, there's a little more involved in terms of the diplomacy, because it's not just so much that you get to the technology and have enough gold and have an AI that's willing to enter into a research agreement. At that point, you've had to establish an embassy and a declaration of friendship. But if you can cultivate those and you're thinking about it well enough in advance, you can position yourself very, very well in order to be able to use research agreements effectively.
There's something else to keep in mind here, too. And although, you know, in this particular case, going education might actually make you get to rifling faster in just this, in the straight consideration sense, but let's say it didn't. You still have to ask yourself, okay, am I going to win the entire game with rifling, or what am I going to do after rifling? And then look at how much time differential you have between getting to a certain unit with the direct beeline versus getting there without directly beelining and actually building up your empire more in other regards as well. You know, if you just got rifles and, yeah, you kill a Civ or two, but then everyone's caught up and you really don't have a fallback, then that's not an ideal scenario. Whereas with education, you would continue your tech path much more strongly anyway. But I think rifling might be far enough down the tech tree where a direct beeline might still be slower just because of how strong that tech path is anyway.
It's definitely slower in vanilla. You can, like, there are three Renaissance techs to get to rifling. Muskets, metallurgy, and then rifling. So you basically just need three scientists. And if you go through education, you can build the Hagia Sophia from Theology for one. And you can finish Liberty for one. I'd finish Liberty, Bulb Education, build a university, fill it with scientists. That's going to significantly speed up your tech. You'll eventually pop one from a scientist from the university. You'll get another scientist from the Porcelain Tower. And those are enough to Bulb all the way to rifling from the beginning of Renaissance.
There you go.
Oh, well, there's something we should add. Thank you for your email, Nick.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
We like it when people openly solicit our opinion because we're quite glad to give our opinion whether you want it or not. But when people ask, it just holds a special place in our heart.
Aww.
I have a responsibility to do X amount of trolling per month, and if I don't reach that quota, I'm penalized. So I believe that's what responsibility means. There's stuff you need to do, otherwise you face consequences for not doing it.
Come on, Phil, you might as well disclose what that penalty is, but I'll say it, you lose 100% of your salary on the show if you don't reach the quota. That's a very harsh penalty.
Well, no, that trolling quota goes well beyond the polycast duties, but it does fit into that as well. I don't want to lose my polycast salary, no.
And if you were to lose your polycast salary, Phil, how could you afford to upgrade machine guns to mechanized infantry?
I have Dan, no clue so how I would manage that.
Comes back to our opinions here.
Speaking of shout-outs received, a little later in this thread, the person who started the thread said, I hope the guys and gals at Polycast, or maybe some really experienced players, would give their words of wisdom on this. It's an interesting situation.
Oh, hey, wait a minute. Us are some experienced players. Wait, I think we've been insulted.
Hey, we have these players on our guest co-host panel here. Give us a break.
Since I was faced with an interesting dilemma recently, I got the mechanized infantry technology late game and couldn't decide if I should upgrade my machine guns or not. The machine guns I'm talking about were for city defense, not part of my offensive army. I like the ranged attack of the machine guns, particularly for coastal cities, and all of my upgrades were for their ranged attacks. But mechanized infantry is more mobile and powerful. What should I do? Before we get into the specifics, I think the answer to the question is already embedded within the description and the explanation of his concern.
Yes.
In his particular situation, right, I'm talking about for city defense, not part of my offensive army, and you contrast that with, but mechanized infantry is more mobile and powerful.
Whoa.
Garrison duty in your city, why are you spending the gold to upgrade them? The mobility isn't your consideration then. In terms of what you want to use them for. So I think you have your answer.
It might be slightly easier for him just to build new or buy new mech infantry units as opposed to upgrading all of his somewhat static defense. There's a reason you garrisoned all those cities, even if it was just for happy.
And if for some reason your circumstances change in the future, that you realize I don't need them for defense or I actually need them for offense now, then you would still have the ability to upgrade them, but then that cost would come when you want to change that purpose. And you can keep them in your city, and also depending upon your social policies, right, if you're thinking I'm going to keep them in the city for defense, if you've gone far enough down the honor tree, then that could contribute to happiness in your cities as well.
Yeah.
I think an exception, and this was pointed out by Van Eck in the thread, the only exceptions he can think of would be if your machine guns have range, so plus one range, and logistics. Now, he says one and two, so I think he's saying and or logistics, giving you plus one additional attack per turn. I don't necessarily agree that if one of those conditions are true, then you should consider upgrading them. all anyway, I doubt that all of your machine guns would actually have that capability. Then in that circumstance, you may decide they are worth more in the field as being part of something that's powerful and has the mobility because it would already have those promotions that you accumulated while it was a machine gun, or heck, perhaps maybe it was a Gatling gun before that, or even before. Like, we also don't know how heavily promoted these machine guns are as well, but just as a general rule, you're talking about defense. Keep the machine guns, keep them in your city, and build mechanized infantry units otherwise. Don't spend your gold. Even if you have discounts for upgrading units again down the honor tree, save that gold for upgrading other units. Like, oh, I don't know, to tie into a previous topic, maybe upgrade some fighters to jet fighters, bombers to stealth bombers, assuming you have the aluminum to do so.
Should we go into how you sunk my battleship?
I guess so. All right.
So over on CFC again, Skibby posted he was noticing that battleships used to be a lot stronger, but now their only advantage is range attack. Together they can capture cities, which is cool, but he said it seemed odd to have the destroyer be the same strength as the battleship. But they're the same strength at two different things. This is what a lot of people in the thread have pointed out. They're that way for a reason. It's like the naval equivalent of your swordsman and your archer. Your archer is there to bombard it down. The swordsman is there to go in and go and defend the archer, which is historically what they were. Destroyers were out in front of the battleships as a screening force. They also had torpedoes and things to go because they were good for being against subs.
I think it's worth pointing out, in consideration of all of this, again, back to the upcoming Fall Pass discussed on the last episode, we had talked about how that is going to remove the plus 33% versus cities from battleships. So, not saying you need to take that into account now, but keep that in the back of your mind when you are considering destroyers versus battleships and what it is that you actually want to be able to do with those units.
Yeah, and it's even though you're taking that 33% bonus away, they're still going to be good for bombarding just the same. Line up three battleships outside of a coastal city, you're still going to they're being rebalanced as opposed to being nerfed.
And also take into account that your battleships require oil, whereas the destroyer requires no resource, strategic or otherwise. In other words, you may want to use your oil for something else, like, say,
fighters.
Or say, oh, I don't know, bombers.
Yeah.
It's all very, very situational.
Of course, as somebody's pointed before, we could say about every topic about Civ, but you know.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, we have said that before. Man, our episodes could be so short. So what do you think about this?
It's all situational.
We could cover like hundreds of topics in a single episode.
Yeah, with that one phrase.
Recorded for episode 152 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Majin, Nullmaster, and Tazik.
No doubt we'll be following up on this in a future episode. It's realization for what if combat wasn't RNG dependent? And the Mian Team may have a few things to say about that, seeing as how he started the threads.
Yes, started by the legendary forum troll. Yeah, I finally got a thread on the show again. Anyway, this is something we've been working on. I've been asked not to get too far still on the mod itself just yet. We are working on a mod for it. But basically, the premise of this thread is to ask exactly what Dan said on the 10 there with the thread title. What if combat was not dependent on the random number generator, and instead resolved based solely upon the relative strength of the units, such that a stronger unit always wins? And this has created a tremendous amount of controversy and feedback of all kinds in a very short period of time. Since I started the thread, it's already on page 7, and it's only been out not even 2 weeks yet. So it's been very interesting debating against people in this thread. There's a lot of conceptions that I'm observing. People thinking that combat suddenly becomes bland and undynamic really need to see the game in practice, because you have all these kinds of damaged units calculations. You have promotions factoring in. You have whether or not you're taking collateral damage, or if they're using fodder troops to initialize damage on you, and how many of them they want to sacrifice. It's not as simple as people like Marlene are making it out to be. and you take a lot more damage under this mod because the deterministic outcomes are weighted as such. But if you will win if you're attacking at what would have previously been like 60% odds, but your unit's going to be red lines. You have to really plan carefully, and it really helps to know your enemy, because if you don't, well, you're going to get followed up and killed, even if you have a more advanced unit. So it's been an interesting experience so far, but yes, always, if you have the stronger unit, it'll win.
Yeah, so, we played with this for a little game last weekend, and one thing I noticed is that you have to pull the units back. You're not going to just run up a stack and have it only get, like, half damage. If this unit wins, a lot of the time it takes three-quarters damage, even if it's a stronger unit. So you have to spend a lot more time healing. Those super great medics that we thought were getting useless, they're not useless anymore.
They were never useless, but they're almost critical now. We're working on balancing that a little bit better, making Drill a bit stronger. We reworked Drill also, well, I should say we reworked for strikes completely differently, obviously, because you don't have these combat rounds any longer. So the previous combat round mechanic that went through the first doesn't make sense any longer. So, now Drill reduces damage. We've been playing with withdrawals and things like that as well. The medic as well is something we're looking at, possibly taking away the ability for the medic promotion to provide healing to other units. That way you have to have a trade-off between damage reduction in the event that you win, just straight-up combat strength, or the ability to heal quickly. And we'll see what kind of gameplay that gets.
So it's kind of like Civ 5 combat.
Almost always someone dies. Stacks. You can have fights in Civ 5 very often where both units live.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You should probably go for that, too.
It's not really so true in this mod.
Well, I mean, what I mean is more the core of it, where the combat strengths are basically used as the relative damage output rather than just, like, a percentage. So it's always based on the combat damage, and everything's all based on the actual unit statistics, not random number generator, although there is a few RNG stuff in there.
There's no RNG component at all in combat. We're trying to get away from that entirely. This is just too frustrating. And when you're playing in these weekly multiplayer games, not even against each other, but just cooperatively, one of the biggest problems is, okay, you have six people. So now you have six times the likelihood that somebody gets hosed by the RNG. And if that person gets hosed, they're going to be waiting for the other five players to hit end turn because they're not going to have a whole lot to do with their small empire, not many units. So that was part of the original impetus for this mod, was that. But I think this could be applied to the general gameplay experience quite well. And I don't see the need, having just done a little bit of testing with deterministic combat, why we had to rely so heavily on the RNG. It's like it's a poison in people's minds, the way I'm seeing it now, where they think you need an RNG to have a turn-based strategy work, and that's just not true. It isn't.
Well, I mean, even with Civ 5, there's a very, very tiny RNG in there, but it's on the spread of the damage. So all of the calculations for how much damage is going to happen to either side is already purely calculated based on statistics, but then there's a very tiny spread up or down that throws in the, okay, well, maybe something didn't quite go well, but it's not as bad as in Civ 4. I find that useful. I mean, you can't always predetermine a battle, especially in real life, but obviously this is a game, not real life, so I think just a tiny amount of RNG in the calculation, even if it's just like maximum 10% of the possible damage or something like that, just to add a little bit of flavor in there.
You see, I think some of those quote-unquote real-life things can be modeled not based on RNG, but by your opponent doing something unexpected, which is kind of what happened in real life, right? I mean, some of the major historical losses didn't happen because of a dice roll, but rather because somebody screwed up. And as the player, you're the one controlling your military, and your opponent's controlling his military. So rather than having the RNG decide that you screwed up, you know, you legitimately screwed up, or your opponent did something unexpected, or he screwed up instead, and that's what's causing the difference here. It's a different model.
Even for what you're going for in the mod, just a tiny amount, because it's at the low level, because right now what you're talking about is the macro level management. You're not showing the micro level, and that's what a tiny amount of RNG in there would help with, micro level stuff.
But why? What does that do for the game? I mean, okay, you might just want to see some RNG there, but strictly speaking, how does that really improve gameplay to have that happen?
Oh, it's not all perfectly deterministic.
And but what's wrong with being perfectly deterministic?
The game's not a spreadsheet, damn it.
I wonder how long it takes for somebody to say that.
Everyone falls back on that.
No, no. It provides some variety. Like, you can't go, I build exactly these three units, and I go crush all your stuff because I'm so far ahead in tech. You know, there
and I know they keep bringing that up, that yeah. I could just calculate that it takes this many units. No, you can't, because there's still variables on where the AI moves its units and other things. It's not going to be exactly that. I thought I had plenty of force archers the other night, but I did not. I took the one city that I never could take the other city, because he kept sending things up to attack me.
Other things include, you know, whether the enemy decides to take drill or combat, or if they go medic, other things including defensive bonuses, fortification bonuses. Yeah, whether they have walls, castles, who gets initiative, collateral damage. There is a lot of things that can convolute the whole pre-planned myth very, very quickly. And if you try to go in with, quote-unquote, just enough units, you are going to die horribly.
That's what happened to me.
From the chat, Canadian Wolverine, RNG isn't necessary, especially with tile bonuses. You don't need the RNG for the micro. And Asiro says, RNG is just to reflect the reality of war. It's not a chess game.
Hey, look, the same argument over and over and over again. But I'd like some actual gameplay justifications for RNG. I mean, aside from just personal preference, everyone's going to have their personal preferences. But it's not a chess game is not an argument. I'm looking for reasons, legitimate reasons, why the RNG is a significant boon to gameplay aside from your personal preference. And if it's, you know, again, if you like it, whatever. I mean, it's in the base game. You could certainly play the RNG. But I don't see a need, per se, for it. And I don't see what it really adds to gameplay beyond preference.
But for me, it's, and again, as Phil mentioned also, very much the impetus for this was a cooperative play. And I'm not saying that I don't think that this couldn't be applied to the game more broadly, but in that cooperative situation where there is that RNG, and toward what Kay and Wolverine has said, you know, that the reality of war is the one who comes better prepared wins. If I get better prepared, you could have all of the units that you need, and you could make poor decisions about when to attack and where to attack, but still, it's that situation where, strictly based on the random number generator, you have lost substantially. You're now in a situation where, again, in that cooperative situation, you're sitting there turn after turn after turn. If you can even stand to do that, sometimes we just say, and I've done this myself, I don't see myself getting out of this hole.
Rage quit.
It's not even a situation of I'm stuck back to where I was. I'm now actually in a worse position than where I started, even though I was better prepared for war than the person I was going after. And now I could lose. That could be the end of my civilization. And in the cooperative situation where you're sitting there ending turn, or you're rage quitting, if you end up leaving, it's true that maybe your civilization isn't in a very good situation. But sometimes, understandably, people get frustrated and they leave, and then by our own in-house rules, we might say, oh, now someone has to go take out so-and-so's civilization so that we can end the game because now the AI has taken over and that's another opponent.
For the argument in the chat about better prepared equals more likely to win, I'll just go back to a paraphrasing an old goody. The best laid plans are completely useless the moment you use them.
You do not need an orange for that, though.
Yeah, so better prepared is one thing, but the moment you actually start doing something, plans are somewhat more useless than normal, unless your opponent, of course, is letting you do your plan. I definitely think that your mod, the mod as discussed, is going to make Civ 4 combat a lot better. Obviously, RNG, luck fight versus slightly more deterministic approach.
We're all tired of losing 90% odd battles.
Well, just anything. It's like, I've got 99.99% chance to win this. Great. I'm going to lose everything.
Your unit does.
You mean I have 99% chance to lose? Right.
And a word goes to Imagine for dropping the F-bomb on the first episode.
Man, I'm a fan. Just lighting up that
Phil. I was paraphrasing Phil.
He's Canadian. So therefore it's saying...
Paraphrasing?
we've been focusing a lot on Civilization 5, but without Civilization, there would be no 5. Yeah, I know it's probably the weakest segue so far, but we'll work with what, you know, we've been dealt.
Wait, that's a segue?
Yeah, okay.
You know, apparently a weak one.
Hey, it got you to ask whether or not it was. So,
it got your attention,
that's
right?
A good sign, Dan.
In the Civ, Ideas and Suggestions said, this name is too low. I think he meant long. Wrote, one thing that has always bothered me in the Civ series is, in general, how regular units and buildings will take decades, even centuries, to build. His idea is basically that as you're building, you should get a percentage of the benefit of that building. For example, 70% completed library would have more than half of its wings constructed, therefore, it should give some benefit to the city. So he proposes that a 70% completed library gives 0.35 science per citizen versus the full 0.5 that a completed library would give.
Well, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
This one I actually dislike. There's some suggestions I'm kind of like, there's some suggestions I like. This one I dislike for a couple of reasons. First of all, it adds a little bit of complexity in a way that doesn't really benefit strategy at all. So it's just kind of like pointless complexity. But I would argue that it actually reduces some strategy because you don't have the same degree of trade-offs that you had before. When you go to build something in Civ, you commit to it to some degree. And you don't get that benefit until it's realized, so you have to plan. But if you got partial benefits sooner, then that element of gameplay would be less important. And not only that, I don't see the realism in it either. So considering that I don't see that there's a lot of realism or gameplay, I just don't like it as a suggestion. When you're building a library and it's like 75% completed, they're not stocking books on those shelves. They got a lot of dirt and trucks and things still around the premises. So I don't know. I don't see it. It was like part of a unit, right? Like, what do you mean?
Oh, you know,
like, you're buying part of a unit. You've got one arm on the musketman, but not the other firing.
Well,
it's an army, right? Dream soldiers. I mean, come on. And then you had to bring in supply lines into the game, which that's never been the degree of detail that Civ hangs its hat on, is having supply lines start to matter to the
system. Just because we're now playing with hexes doesn't mean we're going to get into Panzer General style stuff.
And it's bad enough with the buildings and the difficulty there that, you know, the concerns are the Phillips raised. But then when you're talking about units itself, I mean, we've already kind of joked in the past. I mean, do you really build a unit when it's a person? But anyway, yeah, here's an example for the unit. Like, I'm thinking, how would this work? He says, say you're building a warrior and it takes 10 turns to complete. After one turn, a warrior unit capped at 10% hit point appears in the city. If it stays in the city, each subsequent turn will raise its hit point cap by an additional 10% until it finally reaches 100%.
What?
On the other hand, if the 10% complete warrior moves out of the city, let that sink in.
If the warrior's feet walk out of the city without the rest of the warrior,
then the city will produce a new warrior unit at 10% maximum hit point next turn.
Oh, my God. You can spam so many units.
It's just going to...
You think the end game is slow now? Just wait until it's got to do all the math for this.
Are you kidding me? I start building a legion and then move it out, and then build another legion and move it out. It's 8 times in a city, and then just heal them all. And
well, he was proposing they have a HP cap, so they could just be healed.
Okay. I see.
Yeah, but something's still a little.
But you could also move and combine them. Is like his next paragraph.
You're gonna build your 10 tenths of it and move them all to one tile and combine them like.
I don't know. What you do is you have 10 cities. They each build the tenth of a warrior, and then you move them together, combined, and now you have a full warrior.
There you go.
Yes. Method. This as it sounds.
This is just so full of abuse potential. It isn't funny.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's true.
And I agree. It's just unneeded complexity.
That you might as well be able to funnel all your hammers into one city. Hey, look! I built a wonder instantly. Hey, look! I built a stealth bomber instantly.
Yeah, we did that Call of Civ 2 and caravans.
This would help us reach that achievement to have so many units on the map, though. You know, that would help with that. I'll give it that, if we care about such things.
Yeah.
I will say, too, that the name is too low, that you did give a suggestion, and then you also gave a suggestion on how it would work in practice, so we can see that you put some thought into that, because sometimes people just say, hey, what about this? And it's like, what did you think about that on a boring Tuesday afternoon? You put some effort into this, but...
How many bottles of beer were you down when you thought of this?
Oh, now, Maxie.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Depends on when you are listening to this episode, but if it's before the 15th of October, 2012, or even as of, if you log on to podcastawards.com, please consider nominating Polycast in the Best Produced and Gaming categories, and give the address thepolycast.net/polycast, and provide a comment or two about why you are nominating as well, because that will help the review team. And it's all on Podcast Awards, their whole methodology about it. And we have been successful in being nominated in one or both of those categories several times in the past. Didn't happen last year, but, you know, we're going to try again. So, again, that's over at PodcastAwards.com. We will go to the closing then. Oh, no.
Right to the end.
Already?
Yeah. All right, listeners. Thank you for joining us for... Polycast episode 158. I am the mean teen, and whether or not my glass is half full or half empty depends on what I am drinking. And I am joined by regular co-host Dan Quick.
Can you think and sieve at the same time?
Makalua.
If you can't do that, you may have a problem.
And also by guest co-host Canuck Soldier.
Glad to be here. Hope I'll be back soon.
And Vexing.
Thanks, everybody.
You can't stack them anymore. Maybe it was you, John, that now we're at the one unit per turn. Or one unit per turn. Oh, that would be really terrible. One unit per tile. Wow. Don't give them ideas. Stripes.
No, that would be slow.
In terms of diplomatic modifiers, I went in and I had a look at the ones that were negative and positive in Civ 5 Vanilla and Gods and Kings. I'm excluding the negative and the positive that have to do with city-states. Just talking about, you know, the quote-unquote AI proper. And... essentially, the ratio of negative to positive is like 3-1, 4-1. Like out of 64 modifiers, it's like 47 are negative. What, you want like a 2020 promotion?
Yeah. I think they prefer people who actually have better vision than that.
Yeah.
Phil, I'm trying to take gameplay balance into consideration here. Come on now.
No, realism is greater than balance, Dan. Self-slap.
Yip-slap up the backside of the head.
No. I like Paul's view because he's looking at the glass as half full, whereas Phil looks at it half empty.
Yeah, and what's that glass full of? Maybe you want it empty. I'm just saying. No, you usually involve at least some expletives.
Yes, that too. In everyone's rage quits.
You're right. That's not authentic. I didn't talk about my swear. So I'd be like, all right, yeah, man, I got soggy poutine over here. I'm gone.
No, that is bad.
Or even worse than that, oh, my maple syrup has run dry. I'm so out of here. And to those listening live, you have an idea of what's going to get cut.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yep.
That is, those of you who have been around gaming a long time, that is a reference to the great shooter Unreal Tournament.
Now I'll need to try to think of something smart and original to ask.
We sound smart and original? I mean, honestly.
Speak for yourself. I'm the greatest.
Uh-huh.
And my brain will break down. Oh, well, you can join the rest of us then. That's fine. One of us.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be like a regular panelist then.
Only you won't have the salary to go with it.
Record date October 6th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips copyright Take Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.